Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 106, Barbarian at the Gate. The first 8 years of Alexander Severus's reign proved to be a relatively quiet and prosperous time for the empire. The period was not totally without problems, as evidenced by the periodic mutinies in the army, but compared to what had come before and what was going to come after, the mid to late 220s AD was pretty much heaven on earth. Taxes were low, the frontiers were quiet, and the imperial regime was stable. That period of relative calm, however, is about to come to an abrupt end. In 230 AD, the new Sasanid king Ardashir, who we introduced last week, made the bold decision to begin attacking the Roman Empire. He was an aggressive and ambitious leader, and it is reported that his ultimate objective may have been to completely dislodge the Romans from the east, which was an aggressive and ambitious goal to say the least. He amassed an army on the banks of the Tigris River, which at the time had been serving as the de facto Roman-Parthian border, and began raiding the Roman positions in Mesopotamia. At the very least, Ardashir planned to reclaim this critical region, which had again fallen under Roman control during the reign of Caracalla. Ardashir's raids sent alarm bells ringing across the empire, as observers of Eastern politics knew that Ardashir and the Sassanids were a dangerous new power looking to make their mark on the world. Despite calls for him to immediately order a counterattack, Alexander responded, not unreasonably, by sending envoys to Ardashir to figure out what was going on. He was castigated for this timid response by many in the legions, who accused Alexander of being a decadent coward, afraid of fighting. But Alexander wanted to be sure this wasn't all some misunderstanding before he started a war. Trying to end conflicts with words rather than swords is not a terrible policy, as the oft-cited Winston Churchill quote goes, "To jaw jaw is always better than to war war." But in the coming years, Alexander would continue to do things that confirmed the perception that he was unwilling to fight even a justifiable war, and this would be his undoing. The envoys met with Ardashir and reminded the king of all applicable treaties and territorial claims, and then informed the Sassanids in no uncertain terms that they were encroaching on Roman land and thus risking war. They went on to say that the emperor was more than happy to forget the whole thing, as Ardashir was new to the job and maybe didn't realize what he was doing, but he had to stop his activities right now and stay on the east bank of the Tigris. Ardashir thanked them for their message and told them that he knew exactly what he was doing, that he was going to keep doing what he was doing, and what are the Romans going to do about it if they're so tough. The envoys hastily sent word to Alexander that the Sassanid king had refused to yield, and so Alexander, out of political and moral necessity, mustered an army and prepared to march east. Unlike Lucius Verus, who had taken his sweet time traveling to Antioch the last time the eastern provinces had been under attack, Alexander marched quickly. On his way through Illyria, he drafted a chunk of the Danube legions into his expeditionary force, and, with an impressive army at his back, he arrived in Antioch in 231, ready to begin drilling for the expected campaign. As his army prepared for war, Alexander once again tried for peace. With the Eastern Legion strongly reinforced and the emperor himself present on the scene, Alexander hoped Ardashir would see the error of his ways and back down from the confrontation. But again, though it was probably a prudent overture, the legions were disgusted with Alexander for continuing to jaw-jaw when he should be making war-war. They accused the emperor of being too addicted to the comforts of Rome to defend the empire honorably. I'm willing to give Alexander the benefit of the doubt as to his motivations, but given his later conduct, it's not exactly implausible that the young emperor really was just trying to get out of having to endure the hardships of a military campaign. While he waited for Ardashir's reply, the emperor and his lieutenants struggled to hold the assembled legions together. Discontentment with Alexander's leadership had become second nature to the soldiers, who were annoyed not just with the constant peace offerings, but also with the fact that Julia Mamia was right there with her son, in his tent, controlling him and by extension, them. Not only was it bothersome that they were being led by a woman, or a boy being controlled by a woman, which is somehow just a little bit worse, but Julia in particular was not a beloved figure in the army. As I hinted at last week, Julia's conduct eventually became a liability for Alexander, and it was during the Eastern Campaign that this became apparent. The big problem was that Julia Mamia loved money. Not the things money could buy, but the money itself. She loved money in the way that Ebenezer Scrooge loved money. She loved to acquire it, and she hated to spend it. So while Alexander's regime is often praised for its modesty, in that they didn't spend exorbitant amounts on food and clothes and parties, they often slipped too far the other way and were accused of excessive miserliness, especially by the legions. They had watched their pay cut and their donatives canceled, and every little comfort they had accumulated over the years stripped away, and all the while they had watched Julia Mamia carefully collect and then sit on tax revenue. The emperor wasn't too broke to pay the legions what they thought they deserved. He was just too stingy. But everyone knew that it wasn't the emperor who was stingy, it was his mother. That lady in the tent over there, she's the one who keeps our rations standard and our camps rough. And she's the same lady who's telling her son to make peace with the Sassanids rather than punish them for their transgressions. No, it is fair to say that the legions didn't like Julia one bit. So Alexander's Eastern Army was plagued by mutiny. The soldiers coming out of Egypt seemed particularly insubordinate, but the men of the Danube legions were right behind them. They were unused to the Syrian climate, and disease broke out almost as soon as they arrived. Far from home, they began dropping like flies. Supposedly, they were there to fight a war, but instead the emperor was futzing around trying to call the whole thing off, which meant that maybe they had been dragged out to this godforsaken desert for no reason, and now they were maybe dying for no reason. This, as you can imagine, was not a recipe for happy soldiers. So it was perhaps lucky for Alexander that Ardashir again rebuffed his advances. In reply to Alexander's latest peace offering, the Sassanid king demanded that the Romans completely withdraw from their eastern provinces and cede all territory east of the Hellespont to the Sassanids. So yeah, I guess the time had come for war. In 232, Alexander and his generals divided up the legions and set into motion their plan for a three-pronged invasion of Parthian territory. Wait, are we still calling it Parthia? Who is this that we're even fighting these days? One arm was to head north and take the route through Armenia to Media. The second arm would circle around the south and then plunge north, well east of where Ardashir would be expecting an invasion force to appear. The main army, led by the emperor himself, would march through the middle, directly at the heart of the enemy. The point of all this was to divide Ardashir's attention with attacks on multiple fronts, so that he would split his forces, and all three of the Roman arms would enjoy a numerical advantage. It was a great strategy in theory. In practice, it didn't work out quite as planned, especially since Alexander never led the key attack on the middle of Sassanid territory, leaving his two wings exposed to Ardashir's forces. The whole operation got off to a shaky start anyway, though, as the northern trek through the Armenian mountains turned out to be far more difficult than the Romans were anticipating. But after an arduous journey, they emerged from the mountains more or less intact and immediately besieged the key cities of Media. This assault had the intended effect on Ardashir, who was compelled to peel off a significant portion of his troops to deal with this crisis in the north. In the south, things went much better for the invading legions, at least at first. And just as planned, they marched north from the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and, much to Ardashir's surprise, the Sassanid king suddenly had to deal with a Roman army deep in his own territory. Leaving behind what he hoped would be enough men in Media, Ardashir rushed east with the rest of his troops to deal with the new front the Romans had opened up. So far, everything was working out exactly as the Romans had hoped. The Sassanid forces were divided and strategically scrambled. All that was left was for Alexander to lead the main Roman army across the Tigris, and the Sassanids would be overwhelmed. But this last crucial step was not taken. It seems that Alexander had come to believe that things were going so well that his part of the plan was now unnecessary. The soldiers under his command, eager to get in the fight, were appalled, and now convinced beyond any doubt that their leader was either a coward or a weakling dominated by a cowardly mother. This decision not to invade would have disastrous consequences. The force marching up from the south believed that the emperor had already invaded, and thus that their west flank was totally protected. But without Alexander's army getting in the way, Ardashir was able to take a straight line to the unsuspecting legions and then hit them with a force far in excess of anything they had prepared for. Believing themselves safe on the left, the legions had been sloppy in their defenses, and so when Ardashir appeared on the horizon with a huge Sassanid army behind him, they were taken totally by surprise. Surprise is such a coveted element of war because it so often leads directly to total victory, and in this case, the point was proved decisively. After an improvised attempt to defend themselves failed, the surprised legions were overrun and cut down to the last man. Back in Roman territory, news of the disaster was met with grief and fury by Alexander's army. There was absolutely no reason why their comrades should have been hung out to dry like that. Here they were, the largest of the three divisions, sitting on the sidelines twiddling their thumbs, while out there, men were dying for a lack of support. The damage done to Alexander's reputation was incalculable. But what was done was done, and the emperor, realizing that the initial invasion plan was now busted, ordered the northern arm back to Antioch, where the Romans would regroup and reassess their position. But this order only exacerbated the Roman problems, as the march back through Armenia during the winter of 232-233 was even harder than the march in had been. Men died of disease and exposure and hunger, and the army that finally arrived back in Antioch was a broken shell of what it had once been. Alexander was spared the painful process of trying to figure out how to salvage victory from the humiliation of defeat when scouts arrived with the unexpected news that Ardashir had decided to disband his exhausted army. Like the old armies of the Roman Republic, the Sassanid army was an unprofessional force of temporary draftees. Ardashir's running them this way and that over the course of the last few years had led to his own internal problems, as men complained that their farms and businesses were falling into disrepair back home. Rather than risk a full mutiny that would destroy his so recently won legitimacy, Ardashir released them all from service. Besides, it wouldn't hurt to take a few years off to recuperate from this initial encounter with Rome. Ardashir was playing for the long game, and was simultaneously emboldened and chastened by this first war. The next time he took on the Romans, he would be stronger and smarter. The sudden disbanding of the Sassanids was a godsend for Alexander, and it allowed him to extract himself from the east with his dignity somewhat intact, because at the very least, he would be able to argue that the Romans, despite their setbacks, had actually won the war. But though this line worked on the Senate and the general population, the army wasn't having it for a second. They knew what had really happened, and they were really ticked off about it. Compounding their anger was a message from the West that Germanic tribes had taken the opportunity provided by Alexander's redeployment of the Danube legions to cross the frontier and raid Roman settlements. When the men of the Danube legions found out what had happened, they absolutely redlined. They had been dragged from their homes out to this stupid desert, ravaged by disease and hunger and thirst, all in the name of fighting some war that they never even got into because Alexander had kept them sitting on the sidelines. Those who had gotten to fight had been pointlessly marched through Armenia and back until they were almost all dead. And now on top of everything else, the very fact of their absence had led their families back home to be slaughtered by marauding Germans. Pissed off does not even begin to describe the mood of the Danube legions. both to head off a full-blown insurrection and because it was the right thing to do. Alexander quickly picked up the army he had stationed in Antioch and, leaving behind a few garrisons to keep an eye on the Sassanids, marched the rest west to drive back the Germans and exact a little revenge. As he marched through Moesia and Pannonia, he redeposited some of the various Danube troops back in their home camps and allowed them to clean up the mess that had been made in their absence. The rest of the army kept marching with Alexander all the way to the Upper Rhine, where the German incursions had been heaviest. But once situated in Germany, Alexander quickly reminded everyone that at the end of the day, he really, really did not want to lead an army in battle. After crossing the great river on a pontoon bridge in a showy display of force, the emperor sent word to the various German chiefs offering terms of peace, which included payments of cash and other considerations in exchange for a cessation of hostilities. This was the last straw. The legions Alexander had brought with him from the east described to their western comrades what had happened in Syria, and they all agreed that history was repeating itself. The Germans had plundered Roman territory, and Alexander's response was to offer them more treasure. This growing anger didn't even yet take into account the fact that with their reduced pay, the men were clamoring for an invasion of Germania so they could do some plundering of their own. Over the winter of 234-235, the rank and file mumbled and grumbled to each other, and the possibility of rebellion went from secret desire to open conspiracy. The only thing standing between Alexander and assassination was that the men had no leader willing to head their revolt. In February 235, though, that all changed, and a general named Maximinus Thrax was about to become the first barbarian emperor of Rome. The career of Maximinus is fascinating for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which because he is the one character who really stood out to me the first time I read any part of The Decline and Fall back when I was a kid. The rest of Gibbon was just indecipherable gobbledygook that I couldn't make heads or tails out of, but when he started talking about this gigantic barbarian who as a teenager easily bested the strongest men in the legions and then rose up the ranks to become emperor, well, that I understood. What I didn't understand at the time was what a momentous event his claim to the throne represented in the broader sweep of Roman history. Maximinus Thrax had been born in the early 170s AD, and tradition holds that he was the son of a peasant family in Thrace, hence the Thrax, which roughly makes his name Maximinus the Thracian. But it is also possible that he was born and raised in Moesia. As with the exact location of his birth, his heritage is similarly a matter of some debate. The Historia Augusta, now beginning to slip into unreliability, claim that he was born of a Gothic father and a Sarmatian mother. But most other Roman writers describe him as being Thraco-Roman, that is, a fully settled and Romanized Thracian, rather than a barbarian, in the sense that his parents came from communities beyond the frontier. He was first noticed during the reign of Septimius Severus, when the emperor was returning from one of his eastern campaigns, probably the first one following his victory over Niger in 194. Legend has it that after halting the day's march, the legions decided to engage in some friendly sport with the locals. Young Maximinus showed up and proceeded to toss every soldier the legions threw at him. Severus was impressed, but he was even more impressed the next day when the young man jogged alongside his horse until the emperor agreed to let him join the legions. And the emperor was even more impressed when after jogging for God knows how many miles, Maximinus still bested the dozen or so soldiers Severus ordered him to wrestle as a final test. Maximinus made an excellent soldier. He was, after all, a head taller than just about every other man in the army. He is described as being 8 Roman feet tall, which is basically 8 modern feet tall, and while I find that very hard to believe, I'm willing to believe that he was significantly larger than his contemporaries, not unlike Charlemagne, who is also described as being a gigantic 8 feet tall. But despite his excellence as an infantryman, he was never slated for higher command, and for a long time, looked destined for the standard 25-year service and a gold watch. But over time, he did rise up the ranks, and when Alexander Severus took over, his governing council recommended the Thracian for a slot running the training of new recruits in Pannonia. In this post, Maximinus thrived. He was stern and demanding, but he also reveled in leading by example. Whatever he expected his men to do, he did himself first. He never sat back and ordered his men around. He always got down in the mud with them and shared in the hard, dirty, and exhausting work of learning how to be a Roman soldier. This teaching style endeared him to each successive wave of recruits, and pretty soon, a majority of the men serving along the Danube had been personally trained by Maximinus Thrax, and so a majority of the men serving along the Danube loved him to death and would have followed him to hell and back. When the Germans began overrunning the border in 234, Maximinus was put in charge of a legion, and he was already working hard to counter the German menace when Alexander arrived on the scene a few months later. We don't really know what his level of involvement was with the growing mutiny prior to February 235, but we can say for pretty certain that Maximinus had no love for Alexander. Though the young emperor was the man who had finally given Maximinus a real shot at power, the Thracian had long ago developed a hatred for the Roman aristocracy, and soft, refined Alexander was the undisputed leader of the Roman aristocracy. The rich old men of Rome had never let Maximinus forget his humble origins, nor had their slaves failed to treat him as something beneath even their own lowly station. He found the capital to be nothing but a snake pit of backstabbing weaklings who pretended that they were better than everyone else. By 235, Maximinus was dedicated to his soldiers, and they were dedicated to him. The rest of the empire, politicians, civilians, whatever, were simply in the way. So when Alexander once again tried to make peace before Rome had made its point, this time offering money to boot, it is easy to believe that Maximinus did not exactly clamp down on seditious activity in his camp. But still, however he felt, we still don't know whether his troops' decision to declare him emperor in February 235 was orchestrated in advance or actually came as a surprise. Whatever the prearrangements had been, when Maximinus rose to address his troops one wintry morning, the men spontaneously hailed him emperor and demanded that he agree to the job. After the requisite amount of protest, Maximinus reluctantly agreed, and the rebellion against Alexander Severus was on. After doubling everyone's rations and promising a large donative if the rebellion was successful, Maximinus ordered his troops to begin marching on Alexander's camp just a few miles down the road. Messengers from Maximinus's army arrived in advance of the main force, and after announcing the rebellion, attempted to convince Alexander's soldiers to join up. There are a few versions of what happened next, with one stating that Alexander spoke to his men, promised them all kinds of bonuses if they stuck with him, and actually had gotten them mustered in the field before any defections took place. Well, another version has the emperor left totally in the dark about everything, and not learning of the plot until Maximinus's executioners pushed their way into his tent. Whichever way it went, as soon as Maximinus arrived, Alexander's soldiers defected en masse and swore their loyalty to the Thracian. Not one to beat around the bush, Maximinus ordered a tribune to lead a few centurions into Alexander's camp to find and kill the emperor. The assassins found the young emperor in his tent, with his mother and a few loyal advisors by his side, and after very little struggle, the Severans all lay bloody on the floor. Alexander was 26 years old and had done his very best over the 13 years he ruled the empire. The death of Alexander and the rise of Maximinus represented a major turning point for the empire. Over the last 137 years, beginning with Trajan and ending with Alexander, the average reign of an emperor was just over 12 years, and that includes the short reigns of Pertinax and Didius Julianus. For the next 50 years, beginning with the elevation of Maximinus and ending with the elevation of Diocletian, that average will plunge to something like one emperor for every 2 years, depending on how you do the math. And that doesn't include the fact that for a while there, the empire was split in three, as major breakaway kingdoms in the east and west threatened to destroy the unity of the Roman Empire forever. No one could have guessed it at the time, but the assassination of Alexander Severus marked the beginning of a period where the very survival of Rome was very much in doubt. Foreign invasion, domestic strife, plague, and famine would all conspire to bring the Roman Empire to the brink of extinction, a possibility they had not faced since Hannibal had come marching out of the Alps 4 centuries earlier. Finally, remember when I said last week that I would be making an official announcement about the History of Rome tour pretty soon? Well, here it is. The History of Rome tour is set for May 2011, and I couldn't be more excited. We have designed a 10-day trip that takes us from Rome to Istanbul and hits as many highlights as we could possibly cram in along the way. We'll spend a few days in and around Rome before snaking down through Capua to Pompeii to Tarentum and Brindisi, and then over to the city the Romans called Constantinople. The itinerary is too packed for me to just rattle off everything right now, so for the full details, I'll direct you to the website that we've set up, historyofrometour.com. That again, historyofrometour.com. We have guides and lecturers and experts lined up to walk us through every one of our stops, answer our questions, and generally make sure that we don't miss a single thing while we're there. The package also includes hotels, transportation, breakfast, some group dinners, admission to all the museums and historical sites, and even the transatlantic airfare, if you live in the U.S. and need that sort of thing. And of course, Mr. and Mrs. The History of Rome will both be along for the ride. Space is limited, and we're going to have to run this on a first-come, first-served basis, but I will tell you that we've discussed what happens if more people want to go on the trip than we have space for, and after agreeing that that would be a great problem to have, the answer came back a resounding, we'll do multiple trips. So all the info is at historyofrometour.com, the itinerary, the costs, and an FAQ page that will start populating as soon as we figure out what questions people are frequently asking. I'll also post a permanent link at thehistoryofrome.typepad.com. One other thing I'll mention is that I'm going to be plugging an announcement of the trip onto the back episodes so that people who aren't all the way caught up will know what's going on. This shouldn't alter any episodes that you've already downloaded, but I just wanted you all to know what I'm up to. The History of Rome Tour, May 2011. Sign up right now. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 107, The Year of the Six Emperors. As I've mentioned a few times now, the death of Alexander Severus marked the end not just of the Severan dynasty, but also a whole epoch of Roman history. The political, economic, and social bonds of the empire had been degrading for some time, and when Alexander died, they seemed to snap completely. For the next 50 years, the loyalty of the armies would turn on a dime. Powerful imperial usurpers would pop up with alarming frequency. Barbarian hordes would maraud across the provinces, and the civilian population would be trapped in the middle. Those not ravaged by war would be ravaged by the disease, the famine, and the economic depression that would accompany the crisis years of 235 to 284 AD. During this period, everything that had represented the power, the prestige, the very legitimacy of the Roman Empire was called into question. No precedents were too ancient to violate, no assumptions were too deep to challenge, and no nightmares were too scary to come true. To put it bluntly, Rome probably should have fallen right then. We should be talking about how the assassination of Alexander Severus marked the end of the Roman Empire, that the weight of internal division, external invasion, and economic catastrophe was simply too much to bear. There would have been no shame in it. The empire had dominated the Mediterranean world for the last 400 years at least. Was this not a fair time to finally slip away? But that's not what happened. Instead of marking the end, the crisis of the 3rd century simply marked a change, like the Second Punic War or the collapse of the Republic before it. Just as with those periods, the Rome that came out of the crisis was different than the Rome that had gone in, but it was still Rome. And just as with those earlier upheavals, it was hard for Romans at the time to recognize what a whirlwind they had entered. When you heard that Saguntum was under siege, or that an alliance had been formed between Crassus, Pompey, and Caesar, you didn't immediately think, well, it looks like we're entering a tumultuous period of political, economic, and social reformation. No, you probably thought, well, that's kind of an interesting development, and went about your day. This too was true of the Romans in 235, when they heard that Maximinus Thrax had overthrown Alexander. It was an interesting development, and probably not a good one, but things will probably go on like normal, right? Wrong. Setting the precedent for the next 50 years of military turmoil, the very first thing Maximinus did after becoming emperor was double the pay of his soldiers. It was an expedient designed to ensure their loyalty, but it was a decision that would come back to haunt Maximinus, as he was forced to send out a network of agents across the empire to drum up the necessary revenue so he could afford the raise. And if there is one thing that will get you hated very quickly, it's sending violent tax collectors into people's homes to strip out anything that looks shiny. The second thing he did was immediately relaunch the campaign against the Germans that Alexander had been so reluctant to get going. It goes without saying, then, that the very first people negatively impacted by the elevation of Maximinus were the Germans. In the spring of 235, the provinces had not yet been taxed to death, and the Senate had not yet had their ranks thinned by Maximinus's dangerous paranoia, so the fact that Rome had a new emperor was, for most people, not yet a life-altering event. But the Germans, well, they had gone to bed for the winter, believing that they were about to be paid a great deal of money so that the boy emperor Alexander would not have to fight them. And when they woke up in the spring, they found out that a giant Thracian general had taken control of the legions, and rather than offering them immense wealth, he was offering them only grim death. That had to have been a bit jarring. Maximinus led the legions across the Rhine on a punitive campaign that served two useful purposes. First, it would remind the Germans that there were still consequences for raiding Roman territory. And second, it would provide the plundering opportunity his men had been clamoring for. Maximinus knew that the Senate wasn't going to be happy about his coup, and that was all right with him, as long as the armies of Rome were with him. Giving the men a chance to work out some of their aggressive energy in the pursuit of treasure would bind them even closer to Maximinus than they had been before. But though the rank and file were with him to a man, Maximinus still had to worry about his officer corps, many of whom were either Alexander loyalists or aristocratic malcontents. And Maximinus was right about one thing. The Senate really didn't approve of the ascension that they had just been forced to approve. Powerless to deny Maximinus the prize he had seized, they dutifully ratified his election. But I think it's fair to say that no one in the Senate, even the enemies of the Severans, wanted to see this hulking brute of a peasant emperor lording over their noble empire. So over the course of the campaign in Germany, Maximinus had to thwart at least two murderous conspiracies, one of which was organized by elements in the Senate itself. Naturally enough, these attempts made Maximinus a bit paranoid, and, coupled with his long-simmering hatred for the upper classes, he found himself quickly on the road to Purge City. From his camps in Germany, he started marking down suspects, senators, equites, and military officers who he felt rather too severe not to attempt some kind of revenge for his murder of Alexander, or too senatorial not to attempt to put the barbarian emperor back in his place. And one by one, they were fired, exiled, or killed. Whatever their ultimate fate, in all cases, they were reduced to poverty and their wealth transferred into the open purses of his soldiers. Interestingly, one of the provincial governors who Maximinus passed over, as being neither too sovereign nor too senatorial, was the old proconsul of Africa, Marcus Antonius Gordianus Sempronianus. Interesting because, in a few short years, the man we call Gordian I would find himself leading the rebellion that would eventually topple Maximinus' regime. But the drawing up a prescription list was only a hobby for Maximinus, and it was always done after he was done doing what he did best, leading soldiers in battle. He spent all of 235 in the field against the Germans, and eventually won a hotly contested battle in the mire of a swamp that brought the German resistance to its knees. It was enough of a victory that Maximinus donned the lofty title Germanicus Maximus, and to help celebrate his triumph, he gave his young son the title Caesar and named him heir to the empire. With campaign season coming to an end, Maximinus headed back to what had become his adopted home province of Pannonia and set up winter quarters. In his 3 years as emperor, Maximinus never would set foot in Rome, preferring instead to rule from the frontiers, and unlike Macrinus, who technically holds the distinction of being the first emperor never to appear in Rome, Maximinus did not snub the capital because he was unavoidably detained, but rather because he openly disdained the capital and everything it stood for. The next few years pass with some obscurity in the historical record. We know that Maximinus stayed on the frontiers, focused on defending the empire's northern border, while directing an extensive network of tax agents to canvass the provinces and squeeze as much from the citizens of the empire as they possibly could, by hook, crook, or extortion. Maximinus took the money they scrounged up and delivered it to his grateful troops, who were glad to see that they once again had an emperor who had his priorities straight, enrich the soldiers, and scorn all other men. In Rome itself, and really in all the major urban centers of power, the leading men of the empire were watched like hawks for any sign of seditious activity. If that sign appeared, well, that was when people disappeared. Needless to say, Maximinus Thrax was not the most popular emperor of all time. The general population hated him for his oppressive tax policies, and the elites hated him for constantly picking off their friends and colleagues. All that this growing powder keg needed was a spark, and the whole thing would blow up in Maximinus' face. In March of 238, the powder keg was finally lit in the province of Africa. The local population, rich landowners, middle-class businessmen, and poor laborers alike, had all finally had enough of Maximinus' extortion. When they weren't being bullied and threatened by imperial tax collectors, they were forced to endure the summary judgments of a court system that had been thoroughly corrupted. Basically, the naked theft perpetrated by imperial agents was being declared legal and proper by judges paid to always decide in favor of the regime. After a particularly galling judgment was issued, a few victimized landowners decided to pursue their grievances by other means. They returned to their estates, armed their workers, and came marching back to the city, where they located and killed the official who had ruled against them. The uprising was cheered by everyone not in imperial employ, and pretty soon, the whole province was in revolt. Meanwhile, sitting in the provincial capital of Carthage, probably enjoying a nice cup of tea and wondering what book he was going to read next, was Gordian I, the 79-year-old proconsul of Africa. He had been passed over by Maximinus's paranoid eye for good reason, and was as unlikely an imperial usurper as the Romans ever produced. He had been born way back in 159 to an equestrian family, and had been made a senator during the reign of Septimius Severus. He was, for his times, a unique figure, Disinterested in war and politics, he devoted much of his time to intellectual pursuits and had written volumes on every subject under the sun. His lone public achievement of note came when he served as aedile, and he earned the love of the people for throwing a particularly awesome series of games. Though he had, over the course of his career, commanded a legion now and then, and had even served as governor of Britannia, Gordian was a bookworm and a scholar, not a soldier or a politician. Which is why when the people of Africa showed up at his doorstep, demanding that he become emperor and lead them all to victory against the hated Maximinus, he was likely wondering when he was going to wake up from this strange dream. But it was no dream, and despite his protests that, among other things, he was way too old to be leading a rebellion, the people persisted and began to make menacing noises that he better lead their rebellion or else. So Gordian accepted, on the condition that they also elevate his son, who, for convenience, we'll call Gordian the Younger, to be his co-emperor. Whatever vigorous action this rebellion was going to require would be much better handled by a 46-year-old Gordian than a 79-year-old Gordian. So on March 22, 238 AD, the second and third emperors of the year of the six emperors were proclaimed, and the revolution was on. About a week and a half later, word reached Rome of what had happened in Africa. The senators quietly conferred with one another about the news and agreed to meet in a closed session at the Temple of Castor to decide what to do about this most interesting development. Themselves as fed up as the people of Africa, they decided after an intense meeting to ratify the elevation of the two Gordians. They emerged from the temple and announced to a cheering crowd that the Senate of Rome now officially recognized the two Gordians as the lawful sovereigns of the empire, and that both were to henceforth enjoy the title Augustus. Understanding the effect their declaration would have on Maximinus, who they also declared was now a public enemy, the Senate also announced that an executive council of 20 eminent senators had been created to prepare for the defense of Italy, which was sure to be invaded the minute Maximinus learned what they had done. Further committing themselves to the rebellion, the Senate dispatched messengers to all the provinces of the empire, encouraging the local magistrates to join in the uprising. And then, sealing their pact in blood, they tracked down the highest-ranking official in Rome loyal to Maximinus, his Praetorian prefect, and had him assassinated. But though the standard raised by the Gordians was being flocked to, the Gordians themselves were about to become the first victims of the imperial backlash. There was only one Roman legion stationed west of Africa, and that one legion was not controlled by the Gordians. Neighboring the province of Africa was the small imperial province of Numidia, which had been peeled off from Africa proper during the reign of Septimius Severus, and that was where the sole African legion was based. Numidia was controlled by a general who was either loyal to Maximinus, a personal enemy of the Gordians, or possibly both, and when he heard that Africa was in revolt, he immediately marched his legion to Carthage to put down the rabble. The Gordians knew all about that one legion in Numidia, and after being invested with the purple, Gordian the Younger set about raising a militia to help defend Carthage from attack. But a hastily raised militia of civilians was never going to be able to withstand a true legion composed of professional soldiers. The Africans had all the passion and dedication and heart in the world, but in the end, all of that bounced harmlessly off the shields of the Numidian legion. On April 12, the legion arrived in Carthage, and Gordian the Younger rode out at the head of his amateur army to meet them. The engagement was quick and decisive. The militia was broken apart easily, and Gordian himself was killed in the fighting. Inside the city, the elder Gordian heard what had happened to his son, and, resigned to his fate, chose to commit suicide rather than fall into the hands of the Maximinians. It was an ironic end for a man who had spent most of his life avoiding both war and politics. After the requisite week and a half waiting period, the senators in Rome heard what had happened to their champions in Africa, and the color drained from their collective faces. Maybe they had been too quick to embrace the rebellion. In the heady rush to overthrow Maximinus, they had not stopped to fully think through the consequences of their action. They once again met in closed session, this time in the Temple of Concord, to discuss their situation. Nothing stood between Maximinus' Danube legions and Rome, except for some hastily raised militia commanded by, what, a few rich old senators? Wasn't this exactly the situation the Gordians had just faced, but on a much larger scale? And look how that had turned out for them. Death on the battlefield or suicide in the parlor seemed to be the only choices left to them now. So maybe we should send our apologies to Maximinus for the misunderstanding, offer our supplication, and beg forgiveness. But before they got too far down this road, a senator rose and reminded them of something that they all knew but were afraid to say. Their fates were sealed. There would be no mercy from Maximinus. They were all dead men. Then, following one of those rousing, "Let us hang together, for surely we will hang separately" speeches, the Senate agreed that the only honorable thing left to do was carry on with the rebellion. So they chose from their ranks of the 20 senators on the Executive Council two men who they agreed would be their new sovereigns, Marcus Claudius Pupienus Maximus and Decimus Caelius Calvinus Balbinus, the fourth and fifth emperors of the year of the six emperors. The two men were chosen due to their seniority, but also due to the particular skill set each brought to the office. Pupienus was a lifelong soldier who had made his fame and fortune serving in the legions. He had been appointed to two consulships, had once been prefect of Rome, and by the time of the rebellion, he was one of the most prominent men in the capital. Balbinus, on the other hand, had made his name as a man of letters, an orator and poet and lawyer of great renown. He had also served two consulships and was admired by the other senators not just for his brilliance, but for the fact that his loyalty was to the Senate, not to the legions. It was determined that Pupienus would immediately make for Ravenna, where he would spearhead the military defense of Italy, while Balbinus would remain in Rome and take care of the daily administration of the capital. It was a neat division of labor that seemed the perfect answer to the empire's woes, but in reality, the partnership would not last the year. The Senate once again emerged from their sequestered session and announced the elevation of Pupienus and Balbinus to the citizens of Rome. Unlike their declaration ratifying the elevation of the Gordians, however, this latest announcement was not met by thunderous applause, but rather by boos, jeers, and the occasional flying object. The people had been enthusiastic about the ascension of the Gordians because the Gordians had always been popular with the general population. People still raved about the games the elder Gordian had thrown. But now they were being offered what? A couple of old patrician senators who had never done a thing for them and were likely never to do a thing for them? The citizens of Rome felt that their interests had just been tossed overboard by the Senate, and so they made their displeasure known, loudly. They cried out that the only way this new senatorial regime would have any legitimacy at all was if they also elevated another Gordian to the purple. The only other Gordian available was a 13-year-old boy, who was the grandson of Gordian the Elder and the nephew of Gordian the Younger, which I suppose means we could call him Gordian the Youngest, but instead, we call him Gordian the Third. Afraid that unrest in Rome would undermine the war effort, the Senate saw little reason to deny the people's request, and young Gordian was named Caesar and junior colleague of Pupienus and Balbinus. He was the sixth of the six emperors of the year of the six emperors, and by the end of the year, he would be the only one left standing. Once the senatorial regime was accepted by the people, Pupienus headed to Ravenna to coordinate the defense of Italy. He had very little time to prepare, as it was assumed that the Danube legions would come pouring out of the Alps any day now. And, had Maximinus broke camp the minute he heard about Gordian's initial revolt, he probably could have marched unchallenged all the way to Rome. But Maximinus did not immediately break camp. He was, after all, a soldier. A soldier trained practically from birth to believe that the defense of the frontiers was his only purpose in life. So rather than immediately pack up the Danube legions and march on Italy, Maximinus spent a few crucial days arranging troop deployments so that you would not leave any space for opportunistic Germans to squeeze through. This moment of fidelity to the integrity of the empire was likely one of the key factors in Maximinus ultimately losing both the throne and his life, as it gave the Italian cities crucial time to prepare for his invasion. But once the border was arranged to his liking, Maximinus packed up the bulk of his men and marched on Italy. The few days' delay had done nothing to dampen his temper, and it was a furious, vengeance-driven emperor who led his troops through the Alps and into the Po Valley. He was going to cut a swath right through Italy on the way to Rome, and when he got to Rome, he was going to kill every senator he could find. The insolence of that pathetic body was just too much to bear. It was time to exterminate the whole disgusting lot of them. But Maximinus wouldn't make it to Rome. He wouldn't even make it out of the Po Valley. Not alive, anyway. Next time, Maximinus and his troops will indeed come pouring out of the Alps. But rather than cutting a swath through Italy, they would be stopped short by the stern resistance of the citizens of Aquileia. Maximinus had always assumed that the Italians were a weak lot, made soft by years of peace. But he was about to discover that the old Roman obstinacy was alive and well. Rather than simply roll over, Aquileia chose to fight, something Maximinus had not really anticipated. Unable to break the siege, the frustrated anger of the Thracian emperor would eventually be released on his own men, and when they had taken enough of his lashings, they would return the favor by taking their own frustrated anger out on him. The siege of Aquileia would finally end not with the city sacked, but with Maximinus's head posted on a spike in front of the city gates. I say next time because I'm taking Labor Day weekend off, but we'll be back in 2 weeks for the death of Maximinus, the short and turbulent reign of the senatorial co-emperors, and the surprising emergence of young Gordian III as the sole emperor of the Roman Empire, a possibility I'm sure was not really on his radar when the year began. I'll close this week with a brief note on the History of Rome Tour, which is fast becoming the History of Rome Tours. The response has been fantastic, to say the least, and we are working double time to schedule additional trips so that everyone who wants to go can go. I don't have any firm details just yet on when those might be, but hopefully we'll have it all in place here pretty quick. And of course, beyond this initial itinerary we've created, we've been kicking around some other ideas for future tours that I think you're going to find very, very cool. So even if this first go-around wasn't going to work for you, I want you to know that maybe we'll have something soon for you, too. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 108, Gordian's Knot. Last week, we left the upstart senatorial regime of Pupienus and Balbinus preparing for a showdown with Maximinus Thrax and his veteran Danube legions. While Balbinus kept an eye on Rome, Pupienus had ridden north to Ravenna to lead the defense of Italy. But when the final showdown came, neither of the senatorial emperors were there to witness Maximinus's fall. Neither was 13-year-old Gordian III, who was destined to outlast them all. When they emerged from the Julian Alps into Italy, Maximinus and his legions found the Po Valley deserted. Fearing the wrath of the Thracian general, the local inhabitants had fled to the various walled cities of northern Italy, where they hoped to at least ride out the storm. Luckily for the frightened Italians, the storm didn't make it very far before dissipating. The first major city in Maximinus' path was Aquileia, and when he arrived in April 238, he demanded the Aquileians throw open the gates for their lawful sovereign. But the citizens refused, and, led by two of the senators who had been appointed in the opening days of the revolt to serve on the Emergency Defense Committee, prepared to make a stand. Enraged by this disobedience, Maximinus set siege to the city and planned to make an example of it to the rest of Italy. But Aquileia was well fortified and managed to repulse Maximinus's initial attacks. This, as you can imagine, sent the emperor into an even deeper rage. It was right around this point that the stern discipline of Maximinus, which had always been one of the main reasons his men respected him, began to become instead one of the main reasons why they hated him. He flew off the handle at the slightest provocation, issued punishments far in excess of crimes, and generally put everyone on edge. Blinded by the fury of all this defiance, Maximinus quickly drove his men from love to hate. Further degrading the morale of the troops was the paucity of supplies they were able to scrounge up in the countryside. Most everything edible had been carted behind the walls of the city, so it was the besiegers, as much as the besieged, who found themselves afflicted by hunger, thirst, and exhaustion. Encamped miserably outside of a city that refused to yield, Maximinus's army began to question the judgment of their emperor, especially as he was rampaging around the camps, ordering executions for the slightest infraction. Once they began to question Maximinus's judgment, they began to question their own loyalty to him. After all, what were they doing? Besieging a city they had been sworn to protect? How did that make sense? In the ranks of the Praetorian Guard, these doubts took on a murderous tone. Maybe if they took out Maximinus, they would be pardoned for their involvement in his regime and allowed to just go back to work. At the end of April 238, a group of officers agreed to do what was necessary. They surprised Maximinus in his tent and killed both the emperor and his son. Then they posted the head of their dead leader on a spike and stuck it in front of the gates of Aquileia, signaling to the city that the siege was over. Maximinus Thrax was 65 years old and had ruled the empire for just over 3 years. Though he had provided for a vigorous defense of the frontier, his single-minded support for the legions, at the expense of every other aspect of Roman society, got the ball really rolling on the crisis of the 3rd century. When the inhabitants of Aquileia saw the disembodied head of Maximinus sitting atop a spike, they immediately raised a cheer and opened the gates of their city to the weary legions camped outside. Soldiers and citizens mixed freely and provided comfort to one another, agreeing that it was only the madness of the barbarian emperor that had made them enemies. It was a really touching scene that would have been even more touching had it had any lasting impact at all. Had this actually been a defining moment, where the soldiers realized that their job was the protection of the empire, not the acquisition of immense wealth at the expense of the empire. But this touching moment of contrition was made possible only by the fact that the soldiers had lost. Had Aquileia's defenses been just a little less staunch, or had there been just a little more food to eat, the soldiers of Maximinus's army would have been more than happy to go on and sack Rome itself. But the going got tough, so they abandoned their general and begged for mercy. This is a cycle that will play out again and again in the years to come. When the legions are up, they will demand gold and obedience, and when they are down, they will demand forgiveness and charity. Sometimes, it will take a little while for a particular set of legions to follow through on the full cycle from arrogance to contrition and back to arrogance again. But sometimes, they flip back just as soon as they were out of immediate danger. The men of Maximinus' Praetorian Guard, for example, who had organized his assassination for the good of the empire, were just months from assassinating his successors for the good of the empire. From his headquarters in Ravenna, Pupienus ordered the Danube legions back to their camps in the north, and, when it seemed like everything was hunky-dory again, he returned to Rome. The last few months had been a whirlwind, but it seemed like the upshot of it all would be that he and Balbinus, appointed in haste at a moment of crisis, would now be rulers of the Roman Empire. Who knows? With their reign setting a new precedent, the Senate might find itself recovering some of its old power. The armies were humbled, and the Praetorians were in their corner. A new day was dawning. But it would prove to be a false dawn. Back in Rome, the scene was ugly and getting uglier. Balbinus had taken charge of the capital following his elevation to the purple, and though he was a master jurist and poet and orator, he turned out to be in over his head as an administrator. The political upheavals of 238 had caused numerous disruptions to the services that most Romans took for granted, and Balbinus had been unable to sort it all out and get things running smoothly again. Adding to his heartburn was the fact that rabble-rousing demagogues were using the uncertainty to argue that the people ought to recover some of their old power as well. After all, would defeating Maximinus really deliver them from tyranny if the Senate and the Senate alone reap the political benefits? Riots broke out, and street fighting became distressingly common. Pupienus returned home to find Rome even more chaotic than it had been when he left, and immediately he blamed his colleague for the mess. The new ascendancy of the Senate might have stood a chance had the men they put in power gotten along, but it quickly became apparent that Pupienus and Balbinus had neither love nor respect for one another. Pupienus saw Balbinus as a soft aristocrat who knew nothing about the realities of the world, and Balbinus saw Pupienus as little more than an uneducated soldier who, well, knew nothing about the realities of the world either. When the immediate crisis passed, whatever unified front the two emperors presented was shattered. Adding to the general chaos, in June, a hugely destructive fire broke out in Rome. Now, fires in Rome were nothing new, nor were they anything you could just snap your fingers and put out. But the population took the opportunity to rail against the new emperors and their ineffectual response anyway. The new emperors then decided that the best way to react to all this railing was to simply blame each other for everything. By July of 238, Pupienus and Balbinus had divided up the imperial palace like Caracalla and Geta before them, and were barely on speaking terms. In case you were wondering, no, this does not end well. The new senatorial regime would finally come toppling down at the hands of that old imperial boogeyman, the Praetorian Guard. Since a few of their members had so helpfully assassinated Maximinus just a few months before, the Praetorians had been kept largely intact after power was transferred from Maximinus to Pupienus and Balbinus, which turned out to be a huge mistake. When everything shook out, the same officers who had so willingly carried out Maximinus's commands were still in charge, and despite their recent regicide, they were still gripped more or less by the same worldview, namely, that the Praetorian Guard was at the center of the universe, and everyone else revolved around them. But the Senate and the new emperors didn't see it that way. And not only did they not see it that way, but they actively tried to prove the Praetorians wrong. So rather than being rewarded for delivering the empire from tyranny, the Guard found themselves cut out of the loop, their bonus demands ignored, and their egos generally trampled on. It didn't take long for the Guard to decide that it was high time they reminded everyone who was really at the center of the universe. On July 29, one of the prefects led a group of murderous soldiers to the palace, where they planned to reassert the authority of the Praetorian Guard. Luckily for the assassins, the co-emperors, holed up in their respective wings of the imperial residence, each assumed that the attack had been instigated by the other. They were so busy with their own rivalry that it never occurred to them that some third party might target them both. United, they might have stood a chance, but divided, they both fell to the quick assault. Within the hour, both Pupienus and Balbinus lay dead. Both were in their mid-60s and had ruled the empire for just about 4 months. The sudden murder of the two emperors came as a complete shock to the Senate, the people, and the armies of Rome. But it came as the greatest shock of all to young Gordian III, safely ensconced in his own house in the city. The Praetorians had not rushed into their assassination plot without thinking things through, and Gordian's position as Caesar and heir seemed like the perfect cover for their crime. As I mentioned last week, the boy was in place because the people had demanded his inclusion in the new regime. So all the Praetorians had to do was leave the kid untouched, and everything would just work itself out naturally. Young Gordian was already in the people's favor, so the guard wouldn't have to worry about a popular backlash. And since the new emperor was also only 13 years old, they wouldn't have to worry about him having too much of a mind of his own either. In Gordian, they saw the potential for a popular puppet who they could make dance whatever dance they saw fit. As soon as Pupienus and Balbinus were dead, the guard made a great show of acknowledging Gordian III as their sovereign. The people cheered, the Senate groaned, and life went on. Like the recently deceased Alexander Severus, young Gordian III found himself declared emperor before he had the education or the experience necessary to rule properly. It was thus left to his mother, Antonia Gordiana, who was the daughter of Gordian I and the sister of Gordian II, to navigate her son through the snake pit of Roman politics. As wily a politician as Julia Mamia had been, Gordiana somehow managed to play the Praetorians and the Senate off each other, and while the former wielded considerable influence, they found themselves still answering to a cadre of senators who formed the de facto governing council that controlled the empire during the first few years of Gordian's reign. The Praetorians had not become the puppet masters they dreamed of being, but neither were their sensitive egos trampled to the point that they really wanted to do something about it. Plus, the murders of Pupienus and Balbinus had been made possible in part by the existence of the popular Gordian waiting in the wings. If they killed Gordian, well, that wouldn't trigger thankful applause so much as it would trigger vengeful riots. Thus, an uneasy peace took hold in the city. The people were happy with their young prince, the Praetorians were temporarily held at bay, and the Senate kept a watch on daily administration. But everyone had an eye on everyone else, and they were all waiting for the other shoe to drop. But when the other shoe finally dropped, it wasn't to shatter the peace, but rather to cement it. In 240, a brief revolt broke out in the province of Africa, led by an aristocrat named Sabinianus. He sought to use the same revolutionary spirit that had animated his countrymen 2 years before to his own advantage. But Sabinianus tried to simply declare revolution, rather than riding some pre-existing momentum, and his revolt quickly petered out. Though Gordian's regime was never in any danger, it was a reminder to those closest to the young emperor that another rebellion could break out at any time. But rather than being led by some nut with delusions of grandeur, it could be led by some provincial general whose delusions of grandeur were not delusions at all. Or it could be led by a Praetorian prefect. It's not like these things haven't happened before. So Gordiana and her associates looked around for a way to marry the disparate factions of the empire together so that their purposes would be united. And they hit upon a brilliant solution, a literal marriage to bring them all together. In 241, Gordian appointed a new Praetorian prefect named Gaius Furius Sabinius Aquila Timotheus, and shortly thereafter married his new prefect's daughter, Tranquilina. The combined weight of the promotion and the marriage instantly made Timotheus the most powerful man in the empire. And for the rest of his life, he would be the de facto emperor of Rome, which was just fine with practically everyone. Timotheus had been born around 190 BC into an equestrian family, and had begun his public career in earnest during the reign of Elagabalus. Through the emperorships of Elagabalus, Alexander Severus, and Maximinus Thrax, Timotheus had served in posts, both civilian and military, and all across the empire, he had established a reputation for being honest, efficient, and capable. When Gordian ascended to the throne, Gordiana brought Timocythius into her son's inner circle, and obviously, he impressed them enough that they basically gave him the keys to the empire a few years later. The appointment was a masterstroke. Timocythius was loyal to the emperor, respected by the Senate and the provincial legions, and, most important of all, served officially as prefect of the Praetorian Guard. Everyone felt that in Timocythius they could trust. As an unexpected bonus, the marriage between Gordian and Tranquilina proved to be a happy one, and as 241 AD came to a close, the reign of Gordian III looked like it was shaping up to be a long and prosperous one. But just as the empire was uniting internally, it was suddenly presented with an external threat that would help undo all the goodwill that had just begun to coalesce. Since the ceasefire with Alexander Severus in 233, the Sassanid king Ardashir had mostly pulled back from his western dominions and focused his attention on solidifying control over the east. But in the late 230s, he renewed his ambition to push the Romans back across the Hellespont. But by this point, Ardashir was an old man, and he knew that he would not live to see his dreams fulfilled. So around 240, he elevated his 25-year-old son to serve as co-regent. 2 years later, Ardashir would be dead, and the ambitions of the Sassanids would pass fully to Sharpur, who in time would become one of the most notorious of all the enemies of Rome. He would lead the Sassanids with a martial vigor that would turn the Eastern Empire into a perpetual war zone and cause the distracted and divided Romans to become even more distracted and divided. The culmination of his war with Rome, of course, came in 260, when he will deal the Romans a humiliating blow by capturing the Emperor Valerian alive. But that is for a later episode. In the early 240s, the ambition of father-son still focused on the limited objective of winning back control of Mesopotamia. In 240 and 241, they led their forces in a series of invasions that saw the Sassanids win back control of Kerry, Nisibis, and Hatra, all three of which had been lost to the Romans, while the Parthians had been distracted by the fall of their empire. From these fortified positions, the Sassanids then began to press across the frontier into Syria, which caused all sorts of alarm bells to ring out across the empire. Back in Rome, the news sparked immediate preparations for war, and in 242, Timocythius marched east to personally lead the Roman response. Though the Sassanids had enjoyed an unchecked string of successes, their victories were the result more of Roman complacency than superiority of arms. When Timocythius arrived in Syria, complacent Rome transformed into aggressive Rome, and I think we all know what happens when that happens. At some point in 242, Ardashir died, leaving Sharpur to deal with the Roman counterattack by himself. It would be an experience he would not soon forget. In 243, Timocythius led his army out to meet the Sassanids on the plain of Raecina, and the professional legions triumphed over the amateur Sassanid forces. Kerry and Nisibis were retaken, but in their conquest of Hatra, the Sassanids had destroyed the city, so there was nothing left but rubble to reclaim. Sharpur was driven back to lick his wounds, but Timocythius was not planning on granting the Sassanid king much of a respite. The de facto emperor of the Roman Empire wanted to prove to the Sassanids once and for all that poking at Rome was just about the dumbest thing they could ever possibly do. But, ever loyal to Gordian, he requested the true emperor of Rome come east to oversee the subsequent campaigns and share in the glory Timocythius had planned for the empire. And by the fall of 243, Gordian was situated in Syria with a front row seat for the coming humiliation of the Sassanids. But the humiliation would never come. While in camp, plotting out what his next moves would be, Timocythius was overcome by an unknown illness and died shortly thereafter. The political balance that had been established when he simultaneously became Praetorian Prefect and father-in-law of the Emperor died with him. Without his best advisor to rely on, Gordian decided to pull up short and declare that driving the Sassanids out of Mesopotamia was victory enough for now. In reality, he had more pressing concerns, like whether he could find someone to serve as Praetorian Prefect who would prove as capable and as loyal as Timasithius. After some soul-searching and more than a little behind-the-scenes nudging, 18-year-old Gordian finally decided to appoint Marcus Julius Philippus to fill the vacant prefecture. This would prove to be the worst decision Gordian III ever made. That Philip the Arab would soon be Emperor of Rome should give you some indication as to why. Philip had been born about 50 miles south of Damascus in 204 into a prominent family of emigrated Arabs, hence the Arab part of Philip the Arab. And though we know very little about his early life, it later became rumored that he spent his life as something of a brigand. It seems unlikely, given the status of his family, but the story of his unsavory beginnings fill out a part of the legend of Philip the Arab, and so I offer it to you with all the relevant qualifiers. What is interesting about Philip is that he was not the driving force behind his own ambitions. Rather, it was his brother, Gaius Julius Priscus, who dreamed of empire. After serving in a number of important posts, including a second-in-command spot in Egypt, Gaius got himself appointed to the Praetorian Guard after the ascension of Gordian, and shortly thereafter got his brother a spot in the Guard as well. The charismatic and ambitious Gaius soon won the ear of young Gordian, and when Timasithius died in 243, Gaius pushed to have his brother Philip declared prefect in his place. I haven't seen any particularly definitive answer as to why Gaius chose to have his brother elevated instead of taking the job himself, and it may be that Gaius was simply one of those ambitious men who preferred to rule from the shadows rather than wielding power right out in the open, where it is most dangerous. Whatever the reason, Philip was declared prefect, and the Arab brothers found themselves filling the power vacuum left by Timasithius. Whether they were already planning what would come next is another open question. But what is not an open question is that less than a year later, Gordian will be dead, Philip will be emperor, and Gaius will become his de facto colleague. Next week, we'll deal with the murder of Gordian III and the elevation of Philip the Arab to the throne. Next week will also mark a pretty heavy milestone in the history of Rome, because 4 years after his ascension, Philip will find himself ruling Rome on the occasion of her 1,000th birthday. Founded, as we all know, in 753 BC, the year 248 AD marked year 1,000 on the Roman calendar, and to celebrate, Philip would throw a party that would go down as one of the greatest the empire had ever seen. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 109, The New Millennium. In 243 AD, 18-year-old Gordian III lost the man who had helped make the first few years of his reign a success. With Timasithius in place, the empire had enjoyed the fruits of a capable administrator without having to ingest the poisoned seeds that often accompany those fruits when they are provided by too powerful an underling. Had Gordian's father-in-law and Praetorian prefect lived, there might have been conflict down the road as Gordian came of age, but we need not trouble ourselves with that question, because that's not how it went. How it went was that things were going great for Gordian until Timasithius died, and then everything went to hell. There are a couple of different versions about what happened between 243 and 244 that led to Philip the Arab becoming emperor, but the basic facts are these. Timocythius died, Philip was appointed Praetorian Prefect, then Gordian died, and Philip became emperor. Other than that, the record is contradictory. But the different stories used to explain these basic facts break down into roughly three categories. 1. Philip was completely innocent in everything that happened. 2. Philip started out innocent but wound up guilty. And 3. That Philip was guilty right on down the line. To take the last first, the story goes that Philip and his brother Gaius conspired to kill Timocythius. That is, the mysterious illness that killed Gordian's father-in-law was actually poison. Then, once Philip was prefect, the brothers conspired to kill Gordian and have the guard elect Philip emperor. Call that version Philip the Arch-Machiavellian. Version 2 is that Timocythius died of natural causes, and it was only after Philip became prefect that he and his brother decided to make a play for the empire by killing Gordian. Call that version Philip the Opportunist. The last version is that Philip had nothing to do with either death and was as surprised as anyone to find the Praetorians elevating him to the purple. Call that version Gordian the Lucky. The Romans themselves clearly believed some combination of Philip the Opportunist and Philip the Arch-Machiavellian, and the characterization of Philip as a complete innocent likely wouldn't exist were it not for the curious case of the missing battle. In early 244 AD, Persian histories describe a battle taking place in Mesopotamia between the Romans and the Sassanids that is almost nowhere described in the Latin record. The Persian version has it that Sharpur led an attack against the legions, and that not only were the legions defeated, but that Gordian himself fell in battle. It is easy to dismiss this version as being propaganda invented by Sharpur to embellish his own record, but it is not exactly out of the question that the Romans would try to bury the truth that the legions had been beaten and Gordian had been killed in battle, for propaganda reasons of their own. I'm not going to pretend like I can settle this issue myself, and officially, the cause of Gordian's death remains unknown to this day. But as I said, the Romans themselves certainly believed that Philip assassinated the young emperor, and I'm going to stick with that interpretation. Besides, there is a very low likelihood that, covered up defeat or no, Gordian would have been anywhere near a battlefield at that point in his career. So the generally accepted version among the Romans is that after the war with the Sassanids was shut down following the death of Timocythius, that Philip assassinated Gordian while the imperial court was traveling around near the Euphrates River. With the emperor dead, no one else ready to make an immediate bid for the throne, and Philip right there on the scene, the Praetorian Guard followed the precedent set by Macrinus' men and elevated their prefect to the top spot in the empire. Word quickly spread, and before anyone could do anything about it, Rome had its second emperor of equestrian rank. The lack of a good, credible record makes it hard to figure exactly the order of events and doesn't do much to explain how exactly Gordian died or why there was so little initial resistance to Philip's ascension. So at the end of the day, we have to simply accept the fact that Gordian died and Philip became emperor and that he then reigned for 5 years. We at least know that much. Like his equestrian predecessor Macrinus, Philip was worried about having to deal with a war in the east right at the outset of his reign, and so shortly after becoming emperor, he brokered a more permanent ceasefire with the Sassanids. While Sharpur had been beaten soundly by Timocythius, Philip was wary of pressing the Roman case beyond the Euphrates, especially since he needed to head west and consolidate his hold on power. Plus, there is that missing battle out there that may or may not have been enough to convince the Roman high command to sue for peace. Philip sent ambassadors to the court of Sharpur in 244, and once again, the Romans agreed to purchase a peace that they had no interest in fighting for. Sharpur accepted the terms, either grateful for having been let off so easily, or satisfied that the Romans were admitting a justified defeat, and for a while, the Eastern Front went quiet. Philip left his brother Gaius in Syria, and granted all the authority a co-emperor might expect, Gaius then enjoyed a 5-year run as the unquestioned ruler of the Eastern Empire, while his brother took over the West. Philip was probably back in Rome at the end of 244 or the beginning of 245, and once he arrived, the Senate granted him the title Augustus and named his son Caesar, two declarations I'm sure that came only after suitable promises from Philip that he meant them no harm, and suitable threats from the Praetorian Guard that maybe he did. At roughly this same time, the Senate asserted just a little bit of independence by pushing through the deification of Gordian III over Philip's objections. Objections that arose, most suspected, from Philip's guilt over how he had murdered the boy. Philip's short reign would prove to be a microcosm of the wider crisis period within which it was set. His years in power were defined by internal rebellion and external invasion, and were it not for the fact that he oversaw Rome's 1,000th birthday celebration, which we'll get to in a moment, his imperial career would lack any sort of truly memorable moment at all. This does, however, afford us a nice opportunity to turn our attention to one of those external menaces that would help make the crisis of the 3rd century the truly existential emergency that it was. I am speaking, of course, of the Goths. There is a lot of confusion out there about who exactly the Goths were, when they appeared, how they appeared, and who or what a Goth actually was. So I think it would be a good idea to try to pick apart a few of the theories about their origins so we can have as clear an understanding about this great northern menace to the empire as we possibly can. In time, the Goths would split into two main branches, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths, the former being the ones who first sacked Rome in 410 AD, the latter being the ones who set up a successor kingdom in Italy following the fall of the Western Empire. But right now, they were still more or less a single unified people. The Goths first show up in the Roman record around 238 AD, just as the empire was dealing with its year of the six emperors. While the Romans were occupied with their civil war, this new barbarian horde scorched down from the Ukraine, right past the Danube, and sacked the city of Histria, which was situated on the banks of the Black Sea. The size and the force of this invasion was so shocking that the provincial legions barely had time to react before the Goths had come and gone. For years, the assumption had been, occasional raids aside, that the tribes beyond the Danube were no match for the legions, and so, focused on the domestic situation, the Roman soldiers were simply not prepared to deal with the kind of aggressive threat the Goths posed. But now, they were all on notice. There are two main competing theories about where the Goths came from. The first states that they originated in Sweden, were pushed across the Baltic by a shifting climate sometime between 400 BC and 180, and then slowly migrated south until, by the 200s AD, they were firmly situated in the modern Ukraine. The other theory is that the Goths actually originated in the Ukraine, and that, like the Franks, became a military powerhouse when local tribes combined into a super confederation, whose wide banner eventually supplanted their old tribal identities. Wherever they actually came from, by 238 AD, they were standing on Rome's doorstep, and more than ready to come banging through the door. There was a rumor going around, you see, that the Roman Empire was a paper tiger, that it was rich beyond imagination, and protected only by a reputation they had stopped deserving a long time ago. In just a few years, the Goths would come to believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that Rome was in fact theirs for the taking, when they utterly routed a Roman army, led personally by the Emperor Decius, who would die in the fighting. But that's for next week. This week, we will simply note the opening forays of the Goths into Moesia and Dacia, both of which dealt with persistent raids after the Goths discovered how easy it was to march around the Roman border provinces. Dacia especially stuck out like a sore thumb. Not particularly well settled or well garrisoned, Dacia was an easy target for the Goths. The Romans knew how difficult the province was to defend, going all the way back to Hadrian, who tried to abandon it following Trajan's death. But political pressure and the glorious memories of Trajan's campaign had kept the region on the far side of the Danube within the empire. But it would not survive the crisis of the 3rd century. In the midst of Aurelian's campaign to rebuild the shattered empire, Dacia would become a strategic casualty. By that point, 270 AD, everyone recognized that the province had become little more than an unlocked backdoor into the empire, and its continued incorporation as a province was far too dangerous to allow a little pride in past glories to get in the way. While Philip kept one wary eye on the Goths, he had to keep another on the internal revolts that kept springing up across the empire during his 5 years in office. There are reports of at least 4 separate instances of provincials, citizens, or soldiers attempting to overthrow Philip and Gaius. In the east, Gaius especially provoked revolutionary ire with his heavy-handed governance. Tax collection was harsh, and at least 2 of the revolts of the late 240s occurred in the east and were directed at Gaius. Some evidence even suggests that the last of these actually wound up claiming Gaius's life. But as with Gordian III, the actual circumstances of Gaius Julius Priscus's death remain unknown. After 4 years of uneasy rule, everything finally came to a head in 248 AD. That year, a simultaneously delivered both the high point of Philip's reign and the beginning of the revolt that would eventually lead to his downfall. The high point came in April, a month which the Romans had long had circled on their calendars, as it was believed to mark the 1,000th anniversary of Romulus's founding of Rome. The citizens of the capital expected a party, and Philip happily delivered a magnificent set of secular games to celebrate. Now, to our modern ears, the name might seem to suggest that the secular games were a set of games that had no religious overtones. But that's really just an ironic coincidence of naming, as the secular games were, like everything the Romans did, a highly religious affair. The secular games get their name from the Roman concept of saeculum, which represented the absolute upper bounds of a potential human life. When a saeculum cycle ended, which the Romans calculated to last 100 to 110 years, the reasonable belief was that there would have been a complete turnover in the living population in the meantime. That is, whatever arbitrary day you pick to start the cycle, when you go 110 years in the future, everyone who had been alive at the beginning, from the oldest man to the youngest baby, would be dead. The secular games thus held a particular fascination for the Romans, as they represented a set of ceremonies and celebrations that, theoretically at least, no one had ever seen before or would ever see again. The origin myth of the games reached back into the misty days of the early kingdom when a Sabine man, trying to save his sick children, was commanded to conduct nocturnal sacrifices to the Celtic god Dies Pater and the Greek god Persephone, both of whom were strongly associated with the underworld. Over the course of 3 days, he conducted the necessary ceremonies on the Campus Martius. His children lived, and he was then left with instructions that the ceremony should be repeated once per saeculum from that day forward. How closely the Romans held to this injunction is unknown, but when the high priests of Rome consulted the Sibylline books in 249, while the First Punic War was raging, they were told that the prescription for what ailed them was to renew the secular sacrifices. This set was dutifully followed up in the 140s AD, but then, when the cycle next came around, Rome was too caught up in the fall of the Republic to remember. After Augustus became emperor, though, he decided he wanted to throw games better than anyone had ever seen before or would ever see again, and got the idea to revive the secular games in 17 BC. He revamped the ceremonies, instructed the priests to sacrifice to proper Roman gods, and introduced daytime sacrifices to accompany the traditional nighttime ceremonies. He also introduced the games, the banquets, and theatrical performances that came to be most closely associated with the event. Augustus was not reviving an ancient tradition just to mumble some words at midnight. He wanted to throw the biggest party of anyone's lifetime. After the secular games of Augustus, though, the theoretical underpinnings of the ceremony took a hit when Claudius decided to throw his own set in 47 AD. He had good reason to throw his games early, but Suetonius notes that Claudius was much mocked for announcing festivities that none had seen before and none would see again, when plenty of people had been around when Augustus had said the same thing. The good reason for Claudius's secular games, though, was to celebrate the revolution of a different 100-year cycle, as 47 AD marked the 800th anniversary of the founding of Rome, and Claudius didn't want the birthday to pass unnoticed. From that point on, there were two cycles of secular games, basically negating the whole not-before-not-ever-again mystique, but the various emperors were not going to let an opportunity to associate their name with this most rare of ceremonies pass. So one cycle followed Augustus and led to games thrown by Domitian in 88 and Septimius Severus in 204, and another cycle following Claudius and the birthdays of Rome, which led to games thrown in 148 by Antoninus Pius, and this last set thrown by Philip the Arab in 248. The next time either cycle came around, though, the empire was already undergoing Constantine's push to Christianize, and like a dozen other pagan celebrations, the secular games were neglected. So when Philip announced his games and said that no one would ever see their like again, he at least was telling the truth. Philip's games included the usual sacrifices, accompanied by citywide theatrical performances and gladiatorial contests that saw 1,000 men and God knows how many thousands of exotic animals killing and being killed for the crowd's amusement. When it was all over, everyone agreed that the event had lived up to its billing. No one had ever seen anything like it before, and they could expect to never see anything like it again. Philip was the toast of Rome. But Philip was not the toast of the province of Moesia. The troops along the lower Danube had dealt with the brunt of the initial Gothic invasions, and so far they had not had much success against this new barbarian menace. It appears that in response, the regular soldiers of the legions were clamoring to take the fight across the Danube and into the territory of the Goths. The invasion would offer the men a chance to exact some revenge for their lost honor, but perhaps more importantly, it would give them a chance to plunder a heretofore unknown source of wealth. The empire hadn't really had a good sizable influx of slaves since the Marcomannic Wars, and the thought of selling off 100,000 Goths into slavery was a mighty big incentive to fight another big war in the north. But Philip was content for now to keep the legions in their camps. A northern war might sound good when it's pitched by grunts and two grunts, but up in the high command, they understood that the likelihood of success was low, and the likelihood of doing irreparable damage to the northern defenses was high. But that didn't stop the grunts from talking, and in time, it didn't stop them from revolting against their cowardly leadership. In mid-248, while Philip was back in Rome celebrating the capital's birthday, the legion stationed in Moesia rebelled and declared a man named Tiberius Claudius Marinus Pecationis their new emperor. There had been revolts before, but this one seemed particularly serious, as it involved the legions of such a critical region. As Philip and his advisors scrambled to come up with a response plan, though, a man took to the floor of the Senate and declared that there was nothing to fear. The troops in Moesia, he announced, would quickly come to regret their hasty rebellion and would probably kill their new leader in just a matter of days. With Philip thinking he might have to go so far as to resign his office just to restore peace, he was naturally intrigued by the certainty of the old senator's prediction and thought the man a genius when, just a few days later, word came that the rebellion had in fact collapsed, and Pecationis was dead. This was how Gaius Maecius Quintus Decius earned the everlasting love and respect of Philip the Arab. Decius had been born in 201 in Lower Pannonia, and had spent his entire life serving the empire as a distinguished senator. He had been consul in 232, and had served as governor of Lower Germany, Moesia, and Hispania Tarraconensis, all key provinces with significant troop deployments. It appears that he was in Spain during the tumultuous year of 238, but had he not been, it seems highly likely that he would have been elected one of the 20 senators of the Emergency Council. During the early years of Philip's reign, Decius had been prefect of Rome, and by 248, there was really no one in the Senate, with the possible exception of Valerian, more accomplished and respected than Decius. His bold and correct reading of the situation in Moesia only increased that standing. But just because the rebellion had collapsed, it did not mean that Philip and his regime were out of danger. The troops may have lost their nerve this time, but that did not mean that they had lost their nerve forever. Clearly, a firm hand was needed along the Danube to restore discipline and make sure that things like this didn't happen in the future. And who better to send on this mission than wise Decius, who seemed to know the troops better than they knew themselves. So Philip ordered Decius to Moesia, where he was to whip the legions back into shape and prepare them for the critical task of defending the empire from a Gothic threat that looked only to be gaining strength with each passing year. When looked at one way, that Decius was respected, capable, loyal, and smart, the decision to send him to Moesia was an obvious one. But when looked at another way, taking into account that Decius was easily more popular than Philip and was about to be given command over the largest and best fighting force in the empire, the decision to send him to Moesia turns into an absurd blunder. In any event, the next time the two would face each other would be at the heads of opposing armies, so yeah, maybe Philip shouldn't have gone and done that. But that is for next week. I want to close this week by addressing one little piece of historical trivia that was believed for centuries, but has since been more or less abandoned. The fact that Philip the Arab may have been the first Christian emperor of Rome. This rumor mostly took root as a result of Eusebius describing an incident in his Ecclesiastical History that has Philip attempting to visit a church shortly after becoming emperor, being denied entry by the bishop, and then confessing his sins to gain admittance. His subsequent toleration of Christianity, in contrast most especially to his successor Decius, served as further circumstantial proof that Philip was in fact a member of the flock. But weighing the scales down on the other side are big known facts, like Philip's embrace of his role as Pontifex Maximus and the pagan ceremonies he officiated during the secular games, both of which would have been big no-nos had he been truly Christian. With regards to Philip's relationship with the church, I am content then to believe that given his upbringing in the Christianized East, that he probably had more sympathy to and connection with the Christian communities than most of his imperial colleagues, but it doesn't seem plausible that he himself was a Christian. Philip's positive relationship with Christianity, though, does offer an interesting insight into the subsequent persecutions of Decius, who would wind up issuing an edict shortly after he became emperor, demanding citizens of Rome offer sacrifices to the pagan gods. Decius may have issued his edict to get the troubled Roman Empire back on the right side of the gods, but he may also have issued it as a means of persecuting allies of Philip, as Decius looked to consolidate his own rule. Next week, we will explore the anti-Christian policies of Decius, but only after we cover his accidental rebellion against Philip. It seems that good Decius had every intention of restoring discipline to the troops along the Danube, but upon arriving, was greeted with an ultimatum that he either lead them in a new revolt or die right there on the spot. Loyal to Philip, but not suicidally loyal to Philip, Decius agreed to their demands and immediately about-faced and headed back to Italy, this time at the head of an army. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 110, A Gothic Horror. We left off last time in 248 AD, when a short-lived rebellion in Moesia prompted Philip the Arab to send the respected senator Gaius Decius to the Danube to get the situation back under control. Sending out Decius was supposed to help secure the future of Philip's rule, but instead, it was the catalyst for his demise. Decius arrived in the north and began making the rounds, inspecting this and telling someone to tuck in that, and all the while believed that he really was going to spend the next year or so restoring discipline to the Danube legions. But the Danube legions had other ideas. They had flinched from their first rebellion, possibly because Pecationis was too much of a nobody to be taken seriously as emperor, but Decius, well, you could really picture him draped in the purple. So, with their grievances still unaddressed, they decided to make another play at revolution, this time with Decius as their leader. In the spring of 249, the troops surprised their new commander one morning by hailing him as emperor. They demanded that he lead them to Italy, where together they would unseat Philip and force the Senate to recognize Decius as the new master of Rome. Philip's dishonorable peace with the Parthians, coupled with his unwillingness to confront the Goths, had caused them to lose all respect for the man, and they strongly hinted that come hell or high water, they were going to replace Philip with someone. If Decius wanted the job, they were willing to give it to him. If not, then, as Philip's loyal agent, they were going to kill him. Reluctantly, Decius agreed to lead them. His noble reluctance is always noted in the histories, but it's worth remembering that he was not so reluctant that he refused what they were offering. Leaving behind the troops necessary to garrison the frontier, Decius led, or followed, as some of the histories imply, the rest of the men on a march to Italy, where they planned to confront Philip and force him to abdicate. Word reached Rome soon after that the troops were on the move, and Philip scrambled to assemble a defense force. There was no such thing as a nice, quiet abdication at this point in Roman history, and Philip knew that if he wanted to keep his head, he was going to have to keep his throne, and if he wanted to keep his throne, he was going to have to fight for it. The preparations were no doubt fraught with desperation. Philip knew full well he wouldn't be able to raise enough troops to match the size of Decius's force, but the year of the six emperors had proved that Italy could ward off an angry legionary force given the right amount of luck and determination. So it's not like Philip necessarily believed he was preparing for some suicidal last stand. But luck and determination were not on Philip's side. Decius was no Maximinus Thrax, and Philip was no hardy brotherhood of senators valiantly defending the honor of Italy from an evil tyrant. So the story played out differently this time. In the summer of 249, Decius and Philip faced off near Verona in northern Italy. Despite frequent letters swearing fealty to the emperor, Decius was unable to calm the temper of his men, and however he felt in his heart, that all took a back seat when it came time to act. The two sides joined in a short battle, and Philip's army was easily routed. It is unclear whether he and his son were killed during the fighting itself or a few days after their defeat. But within a week of the battle, Philip was dead, and Decius was on his way to Rome to have the Senate ratify his ascension to the throne. Philip the Arab was 44 years old and had ruled the empire for 5 years. As I said, Decius was no Maximinus Thrax, and the Senate was more than happy to raise one of their own to the purple. In addition to the title Augustus, they also gave Decius the honorific Traianus, a hopeful nod that the new emperor would prove to be as wise and as capable as the great Trajan had been. Decius sent the legions who had carried him to power back to the Danube, while he himself stayed in Rome to consolidate power and take stock of the empire he now led. The Moesian legions received a healthy donative for their day's work, temporarily stilling their desire for a war with the Goths. Eventually, though, they would get their war, and soon come to realize that maybe they shouldn't have been quite so eager to take on the northern barbarians. This moment of realization probably came right around the time they were all being hacked to death in a muddy, bloody swamp. When Decius was done taking stock of the Empire, he declared that he did not much like what he saw. The Sassanids had been dishonorably paid off in the east, the Goths menaced the north, and Rome itself was a cesspool of vice and corruption. The Roman Empire had lost its way, and the new emperor was determined to get it back on the right track. The main problem, Decius decided, was not shifting demographics or economic fluctuations or the threat of foreign invasion, but rather the loss of public virtue. That virtue, which had helped Rome win the favor of the gods, had been abandoned, and so the gods had abandoned Rome. To help the empire get back on the good side of those supernatural forces that obviously determine the course of earthly affairs, Decius dreamed up two major initiatives. First, he was going to demand that every citizen in the empire offer sacrifices to convince the gods that Rome had not forsaken them. And second, he was going to revive the long-abandoned office of censor so that someone would be in place to regulate and legislate public morality. Taken together, Decius figured that this would be enough to please the gods and prevent them from heaping any more misery on the Romans. It seems, though, that given what's about to happen, the gods were not at all impressed by these offerings. Decius started in January of 250 by issuing his famous edict that every citizen of the empire must offer a sacrifice to the gods on behalf of the emperor. The edict seems innocuously pious enough, but it was well known that a certain minority of citizens were going to have a big problem with this seemingly simple request, and it is completely plausible that Decius's idea of getting back on the good side of the gods had nothing to do with sacrifices at all, but instead had everything to do with the complete suppression of Christianity. The mechanics of the edict were simple. A magistrate would announce that everyone in his municipality had, say, 30 days to offer the proper sacrifices, and then you would be issued a ticket after having performed said sacrifices. The officials would then come around after the 30 days were up and make sure everyone had their ticket. And if you didn't have it, well, that was treason, and treason meant torture and death. Across the empire, Christians heard about the edict, immediately recognized it as being totally incompatible with their belief system, and tried to figure out what exactly they were going to do. Some broke right away, made the necessary sacrifices, and either left Christianity behind forever or asked for forgiveness after the fact. But most refused and hoped that the Roman authorities would not pursue any heavy-handed reprisals. What was the big deal if a few Christians didn't take part in these pagan rituals? They paid their taxes and kept out of trouble, and for the last few years that had been more than enough to keep them flying below the imperial radar. But Decius had no intention of pursuing a policy of toleration, and when the first batch of Christians let time expire without making a sacrifice, Decius recommended to the local authorities that they go ahead with the torture and the executions. Like a wave spreading across the empire, defiant Christians were rounded up and killed as the deadline for sacrificing came and went in each new province. Over the course of 250, thousands of Christians, both prominent and obscure, were executed, including Pope Fabian, who set the tone for the faithful by accepting martyrdom at the end of January 250, not long after the edict was first issued. Perhaps revealing what this was all really about, Decius then prevented the Christians from electing a new bishop of Rome, and the office remained vacant until the emperor left the capital to go fight the Goths 18 months later. Not to get too far off into ecclesiastic history, but when a new pope finally was elected again, it set off a minor schism within the church over the question of how exactly to treat those Christians who had made the sacrifices and now wanted to return to the church. Did they need to be rebaptized, or was sincere repentance enough? And this was a heavy question that caused a great deal of angry debate. So, while not succeeding in eliminating Christianity, Decius did do much to sow some serious discord within the church. while the persecution of Christians raged across the empire, Decius made a play to further reintroduce the Romans to the virtuous ways of their forefathers by reviving the office of censor. But rather than claiming the title for himself, as previous emperors had done, Decius picked a man he thought worthy of the job and offered Publius Licinius Valerianus the opportunity to lead Rome's moral revival. But Valerian, as we know him today, thought long and hard about the offer, and in the end risked the wrath of the emperor by declining to take the job. Not only was the task shaping up to be an impossible one, hey, you see that water over there? Make it run uphill, okay? But the censorship was, when you read the fine print, an incredibly powerful office. To don the title of censor would be to don a title that would make Valerian practically the equal of Decius, and that was a very dangerous place to be. He could see that in time, that kind of power would probably make Decius violently paranoid, even if it had been his idea to begin with. Valerian was a smart guy. The job was impossible, and the position was just too dangerous. No good could come of it, so he declined. He told Decius that the office was too august to be held by anyone but the Augustus himself, and asked instead for a regular old military posting in Germany. Decius granted the request and let Valerian slip away with his head intact. We do not know whether the emperor planned to let the matter drop completely, or whether he was dead set on bringing the censor back to Rome, because shortly after Valerian's refusal, the Goths once again invaded the empire, bringing an end to Decius's experiments with public virtue. In late 250, a Gothic king named Cniva, that's the pronunciation I'm going with, led an army across the Danube and began running amok in Thrace and Moesia. Though we call this army the Goths, they were actually a far more cosmopolitan force than the name suggests. Cniva raised a standard that Germans and Sarmatians and even a healthy number of Roman deserters flocked to. So while we call them the Goths, remember that a number of different nationalities all fought for Cniva, not just the Goths themselves, though they were the thick trunk of the invading army. Cniva's forces overran the border defenses easily, which was what prompted so many Roman soldiers to desert, and after extracting a large payment from Marcianopolis not to sack their city, the Goths were soon laying siege to the city of Nicopolis. Provincial leaders begged Decius to personally lead a relief army to evict these most unwelcome guests, and Decius, recognizing how dire the situation was, immediately began preparations for the march north. In early 251, he was on his way along with his 24-year-old son Herennius, who Decius had induced the Senate to make his co-Augustus shortly before their departure. This new father and son team was supposed to destroy the Goths and then go on to found a great new dynasty. But instead what happened is that they both died and went down in history as the first emperors to fall in battle against a foreign enemy. Now the Persians will tell you that that honor really belongs to Gordian III, but let's not concern ourselves with that for now. The Goths had not taken Nicopolis by the time Decius and his reinforcements arrived, so Cniva abandoned the siege and headed off for greener pastures. But for the Romans, this was not about simply coming to the aid of Nicopolis. It was about throwing the Goths out of the empire entirely. So Decius and his army pursued Cniva across the countryside. No slouch when it came to strategy and tactics, the Gothic kings saw the Romans coming hot on his heels and decided to use their headlong charge against them. Decius was pushing his troops hard on the assumption that Cniva was running as fast as he could, but what the Gothic king was actually doing was turning his army around and pointing them straight back at the unsuspecting legions. Believing the Goths to be nowhere near them, the Romans set up camp for the night, and though guards were of course posted, no one was expecting to be doing any fighting for at least a couple of days. But then, out of nowhere, the full Gothic army appeared over a hill and came barreling at the Roman position. Caught completely off guard, Decius tried to keep his men in line, but the shock of the attack scattered the legions, and the subsequent retreat involved a lot more running than the Emperor probably would have liked. Satisfied that he had spooked the Romans off the chase, Cniva then headed off to the nearby city of Philippopolis, which he planned to sack before the Romans were able to regroup. The Goths were, after all, here to plunder the wealth of the empire, not engage the legions in unproductive battles. But by not following up on his surprise attack, Cniva allowed Decius time to reform his embarrassed army. The emperor rebuilt their confidence by leading them against a series of much smaller German forces who were attempting to join Cniva's invincible army, and pretty soon they were feeling okay about themselves again. Cniva's invincible army, though, was only invincible when fighting in head-to-head battles. When it came to laying siege to cities, they lacked the kind of sophisticated equipment necessary to do the job right, and the siege of Philippopolis, like the siege of Nicopolis, took longer than it was supposed to. And while the Romans regained their strength, Cniva saw the strength of his own army slowly slipping away. But eventually, the citizens of Philippopolis could hold out no longer, and they were forced to surrender their city. In the subsequent sack, it is reported that 100,000 men, women, and children were killed. Cniva, emboldened, then grabbed Titus Julius Priscus, the governor of Thrace, who may or may not have been in on the whole thing and been the one who betrayed Philippopolis to the Goths, and proclaimed Priscus emperor of the Roman Empire under the generous protection of the Gothic king. This attempt to seize the empire in one fell swoop was short-lived, though. Not only did Priscus die shortly after becoming emperor, cause of death unknown, but Decius and his reinvigorated army arrived on the scene and slowly began to surround the Gothic position. Aware that the siege had depleted his forces dangerously, Cniva decided it was time for the Goths to make their getaway. They piled their carts high with accumulated treasure and made a run for the northern border. Confident both in his numerical superiority and just the superiority of the legions in general, Decius chased down the fleeing Goths and made every effort to fight them as soon as possible. A decisive battle would prove to the Goths that messing with Rome got you nowhere, and would prove to the Romans themselves that the dominance of the legions was still a matter of fact, not a matter of imagined reputation. But boy, did he wind up proving just the opposite. The mistake Decius made was that he was so eager to engage the Goths that he basically ceded the decision of where the battle would take place to Cniva. The Gothic king chose a spot just south of the Danube near the town of Abritus and arranged his men in three lines, strategically positioning the third line just behind some marshy swampland so that the front Gothic ranks kept the site screened from the Romans. I won't say that the battle was already decided before the first spear was tossed, but allowing Cniva to pick the time and the place of the battle was a fatal blunder. Remember, kids, if there is one thing the history of warfare has proven again and again, it's that, like real estate, the name of the game is location, location, location. Don't let your enemy pick the battle site. Chances are the spot he will pick is a spot that complements his strengths and negates yours. If he offers battle someplace you're not sure of, avoid the temptation to fight it out, and instead, focus on drawing him into a spot of your choosing. I can promise you, you will like the result a whole lot better. Just ask Decius. According to legend, the Battle of Abritus started ominously for the Romans, as Herennius was struck by an arrow and killed in the opening minutes of the fight. Decius, however, used the shocking death of his son as a way to rally his men, crying out, "Let no one mourn. The death of one soldier is no great loss to the Republic." This stirring scene is, of course, apocryphal, but I figured I'd pass it along since that was the way the Romans told the story to each other. Regardless, the moment was soon forgotten as the legions plunged into the damp hell that awaited them in front of that third Gothic line. The legions pushed the Goths back, and pushed the Goths back, and pushed the Goths back, leaving the Romans with the impression that the battle was now going great. The first Gothic line broke, and then the second gave way, and the Romans pursued the fleeing barbarians with reckless abandon, sure that victory was just within their grasp. But the legions pursued the fleeing Goths right into the marshlands and right into Cneva's trap. Bogged down in the marsh, the Romans were surrounded by the last Gothic line. Fierce combat followed, but the terrain was too much for the Romans to overcome, and the battle turned into a slaughter. Theseus himself disappeared in the fighting, and his body was never recovered from the swamp. He was 50 years old and had ruled the empire for 2 years. The governor of Upper Moesia, a general named Trebonianus Gallus, was left in command of the remnants of the Roman army, and soon after the battle, he negotiated a peace with Cneva. The Goths would be allowed to leave Roman territory unmolested with all the treasure they had accumulated, which, yeah, it's not like the Romans could have stopped Cneva from doing anything he wanted anyway. But the Roman general also worked out a deal that would pay Cneva an annual tribute in exchange for the Gothic king agreeing to stay out of Roman territory. This last bit became the source of a later rumor that Gallus had actually conspired with Cneva before the battle to ensure a Roman defeat. But given all the other circumstances of the battle and his later conduct, there is no reason to believe that Gallus had anything at all to do with the defeat at Abritus. The Battle of Abritus was one of the most shocking setbacks in Roman history. Though not quite as existentially terrifying as Cannae, the results of the battle still came as a mortal shock to the folks back home. The emperor was dead? His army destroyed? Who or what is going to protect us now? Decius had set out to prove that the Romans were still the biggest kid on the block, and had wound up proving exactly the opposite. And this new Gothic terror filled the Romans with a dread they had not really felt since the days of Hannibal. How are we going to survive if our supposedly invincible legions are so easily destroyed? There was no ready answer, and the citizens of the empire began to live with a fear in their hearts that they had never experienced before. Really, at that moment, it did not seem like the end was that far off. I want to end this week with a quick note on the tours. The first trip, as I already mentioned, is sold out, but we do have some space available on trips 2 and 3, which will run from May 17 to May 26, and from May 28 to June 7, respectively. It will be exactly the same itinerary, just over a different span of days. So if the first set of dates didn't work out for you, or you thought you had already missed your chance to go, then by all means, come along on one of the other trips. I should also note that we have removed the transatlantic airfare from the tour package. Once we started to get a feel for what would work out best for everyone, especially since so many international travelers will be along, it became obvious that the airfare to Rome and from Istanbul was more of a hindrance than a help to most people, so we made the decision to drop that part of the package. We will by all means help everyone make the proper arrangements, but just know that the price you see no longer includes those tickets. So, thehistoryofrometour.com. Act now, because, as they say, good seats are still available, but won't be forever.